red flags for counsel that there was a serious problem here.
So the theory is that he was under this sway even as the trial was going forward and not fully able to communicate?
That's correct, Your Honor. Even if the record shows that at his trial, he doesn't say, I did it. He said, if that's what the paper says, meaning his confession, that's what I said. He never says at trial, I did it, I killed this child. He repeatedly suffers from duress from his mother and also police coercion that made him confess on the day that he was arrested.
But the state makes a point that if you go down this path of influence on the part of his mother and jealousy on her part and so on, one could just as readily arrive at the end with him killing the baby for his mother as her doing it. I mean, these are terrible injuries that this child dies of.
Absolutely. It is a very sad case, and although respondent argues that it's possible that she made him do it, the fact is that these eight affiants would have consistently testified that Mr. Terrell was gentle, was around children, was around their own children, and there had never been an issue. Whereas Elizabeth Terrell, from the time he was a child, was sexually abusing her own son. It doesn't take that big of a leap to get from that place to the fact that maybe she harmed another child here. When she had motive and opportunity, she was jealous that Mr. Terrell was engaging in a relationship with the child's mother. She said she wanted the child out of her house, and she had time to do this while Mr. Terrell was out of the house.
Now, wouldn't you need, I'm just trying to think how you could actually put together this theory and overcome the difficulties of contradicting what had been said at the first trial. The state court on post-conviction is concerned about that, as I'm sure anybody would be. I mean, wouldn't you need some psychiatric evidence about Mr. Terrell indicating that his will has been overborne? So otherwise, you know, I'm looking at this statement that happens to be quoted in the state's brief at page 15, where he says, I can't conceive how a jury of now accepting diametrically opposed statement by the defendant, which contradicts everything that was said at trial. So you need, I feel like you need some way into this new theory.
Your Honor, we believe that statement is unreasonable. The fact is that witness after witness would testify to the fact that Mr. Terrell was under duress from his mother, and the court completely ignored these affidavits and didn't take that into consideration.
Under duress on the witness stand?
Under duress for his entire life, including and up to the witness stand. The fact is he was on the witness stand and really did not defend himself whatsoever. He said, if that's what's on the paper, that's what's on the paper. And as is shown in our brief, the reason he did that is, one, because he was under the duress of his mother, and two, his confession came out due to police coercion. They told him, you have to tell us something for you to leave. Let's not forget, Your Honors, he was 18 years old at the time and has a very, very low IQ. He was sexually abused from the time he was a child. He was very easily swayed and was under the control of an abusive, controlling drug addict from the time he was a child.
But you're still left with, I guess, you know, of course, the standard of review in these cases. And for the state court to take a look at this, I'll just stick for the moment with the prejudice side. Let's assume you're right and maybe counsel should have spent more time seeking out and talking to these people. But the state court evaluates it and actually says, I don't foresee there would be any hope at all of there being a different verdict, which it's a pretty, that's giving him a lot. Can we say that's an unreasonable conclusion?
Yes, Your Honor, it is an unreasonable conclusion because Mr. Terrell was prejudiced by his counsel's performance. There's a reasonable probability that but for the failure to investigate, the result of the trial would have been different and his chances of acquittal would have been better than negligible. It's not the choice between two theories where counsel went with one theory over the other. Counsel failed at the outset to investigate a well-supported defense that would have left Mr. Terrell not up on the stand on his own, pleading his own innocence. He would have been corroborated by a number of witnesses
But he never says, my mother did it or anything, so it's not quite corroboration. It would have been a different theme altogether.
But he did say, Your Honor, that he didn't do it on the stand, which obviously with his confession is problematic. But if you have eight people saying he didn't do it, here's why he confessed to it. That's a whole different story. That's a completely different trial. The very act of not investigating these facts precluded counsel from giving him a viable and potentially successful defense on trial, which is especially egregious where counsel was on notice that Mr. Terrell may have been under the duress of his mother. Had counsel conducted an adequate investigation, there's a reasonable probability that the result of his trial would have been different, and the Illinois court's conclusion otherwise is unreasonable.
Well, presumably the voluntariness of the confession was litigated before the confession was admitted, right?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Right.
The theory, if you will, that counsel did present at trial was police coercion, that the police told him you have to say something in order to leave.
So that's the theory that was litigated, not I'm doing it for my mother.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If I understand your position, counsel, the defendant was telling relatives that he was taking the fall for his mother while the case was going forward. Is that right?
That is correct. And
but he wasn't telling his lawyer.
That is correct. There are a number of reasons he may have not told his lawyer. We don't know what his
lawyer
do.
Do we have any testimony from him about that?
We do not. That would be something that would be taken up during the evidentiary hearing that we've asked for in the alternative.
Yeah, why was the lawyer called? I was baffled by that. Is the lawyer dead?
I'm honestly not sure why the lawyer wasn't called, Your Honor.
That was a long time ago.
I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if that's right. If you have further questions, I'm happy to answer them.
I think Judge Hamilton may have had a question.
Just double-check my notes. Go ahead.
Ms. Saburn.
Good morning, Your Honors. Erica Seaburn from the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of the respondent. May it please the Court? This Court should affirm and hold that the state court's disposition was not unreasonable within the meaning of AEDPA in that it was not so far outside the bounds of permissible differences of opinion as to rise to the level of unreasonableness. I'd like to begin with the performance prong. There is no evidence that petitioner ever told his trial counsel that he had falsely confessed to protect Elizabeth. In fact, there's evidence to the contrary based on the testimony that petitioner gave, not just at the pretrial suppression hearing where the issue of police coercion was litigated, but also during the trial itself. Even in his counseled post-conviction petition, which is in the record at Exhibit J, not only is there no affidavit from petitioner whatsoever, even in the body of the petition itself, it never states petitioner told his trial counsel that he falsely confessed.
So where is this lawyer? Can you help us out?
The trial attorney?
Yeah.
I don't know, and the post-conviction record doesn't say anything about whether either party tried to contact him. The trial took place in 1986. I don't know where the trial attorney is.
No, I understand. I mean, some of us are actually around in 1986, but
I should say that the record doesn't reflect one.
All right, thank you. But I guess the thing that's so odd about this is usually when there's a claim of ineffectiveness of counsel, one of the reasons you even need the post-conviction proceeding is because the record is not going to reveal counsel's strategic reasons for doing things, whether counsel thought about it. The books are full of cases where counsel either says, you know, I was pursuing path A, not path B, or counsel saying it never dawned on me, or whatever counsel says. What concerns me about the state's argument on the performance side of things is that you seem to be equating contacting a particular person with a discussion about this theory of the case. And just because you contacted somebody, you know, any of these witnesses doesn't necessarily mean that any of this was discussed. And so I feel that there's a huge gap in the record that counsel could have said what was discussed, or perhaps the witness could have said what was discussed. But just because there was a contact, and certainly in the case of the four witnesses that we don't know whether there was any contact or not, I can't imagine drawing any inference about what was talked about or not.
Well, I suppose I have two answers to that. First of all, is that one of the reasons that the trial attorney was never brought into the post-conviction proceedings was because the trial court judge made his prejudice ruling, I don't foresee of there being any hope at all. If the trial court had thought that there was a possibility of a meritorious prejudice argument, then the post-conviction proceeding could have gone forward, and at that point there might have been an evidentiary hearing at which the trial counsel could have been called and asked all these questions.
But, of course, that gives us a state record that's on which we almost have to assume that there is insufficient performance at this point.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I suppose this is the second answer to that question. I think the record does, in fact, reflect trial counsel's contact and discussions with the relatives. For example, two of the affiants, Eloise Chambers, a cousin, and Drew Terrell Sr., who is petitioner's father, both stated in their affidavits that they told trial counsel everything in their affidavits about Elizabeth's alleged involvement in the murder. So that indicates that there was not just contact, but actual discussion as to this theory of the crime. And the fact that trial counsel knew this information but chose not to present it is an indication that there was a strategic choice not to present this theory. As the Harrington court indicated, this is an indication of trial tactics as opposed to sheer neglect. The record also indicates that trial counsel had sufficient contact with many other members of petitioner's family.
But we don't know anything about the content of those contacts.
We do to a certain extent, Your Honor. Three other relatives testified at the pretrial suppression hearing. Petitioner's stepmother, Teresa Terrell, his aunt, Gail Terrell, and his great-aunt, Irene Lewis. In addition, there was yet another relative, Lottie Banks, a cousin, who did testify at petitioner's.
Well, she's the one at the sentencing who says he's doing this for his mother.
Yes, but her statement is a little more equivocal than that. I believe what she says is, God help me if I am wrong, but I think maybe he's saying this in order to protect his mother. It's by no means a statement of certainty. It just seems to be based on her intuition. But my point is, I think the record reflects that petitioner's counsel was having continuous contact with both petitioner's immediate and extended family throughout pretrial all the way through to sentencing.
But four of the people didn't have contact with him.
Well, four of the people were silent on the issue of contact, but just indicated that they had never been asked to testify. One of those four people is Teresa Terrell. She indicated in her affidavit, I wasn't asked to testify at trial, but she did testify at the pretrial suppression hearing, and she testified at sentencing. So in that case, we do have a fairly good idea of what her contact with counsel was. The three other relatives, Elsie Teague, Madeline Terrell, and Napoleon Wells, all indicated they weren't asked to testify, but they didn't say anything about whether they were contacted by trial counsel or what the extent of that contact was.
Did any of these relatives claim in the post-conviction proceedings in state court to have any evidence of this theory that the mother did it, or was it based on their suppositions arising out of their familiarity with the relationship between mother and son?
Well, some of the relatives, I believe it was some of the relatives, excuse me, one of the affiants, Earlene Wadlington, didn't say anything about this particular crime. She was just able to say things about petitioner's relationship with his mother based on her own personal observations. And many of the other affiants had personal observations about that relationship. But in terms of their information about petitioner's guilt for this crime, that was all based on hearsay communications, either from petitioner through Elizabeth, which would have been double hearsay, or in the case of Napoleon Wells, his claim that Elizabeth told him, which would not have been admissible as a statement against interest under Illinois law. So there was no actual evidence besides this hearsay information as to the idea that petitioner just confessed in order to protect Elizabeth.
Elizabeth doesn't testify at the trial.
No, she does not. Petitioner has argued that counsel should have presented both of these theories somehow, both as sort of broad alternate perpetrator theory of the crime, and then have the relatives testify specifically that they thought that Elizabeth had done this. Now,
what about the idea, though, that a better investigation allows counsel to see if there is any evidence that will be admissible? I certainly take the state's point that in the form that we're looking at it, an awful lot of it doesn't seem to be. But that doesn't mean at the investigation stage, I mean, goodness, look at Rule 26 of the civil rules. I mean, things that are likely to lead to admissible evidence, and on the criminal side, no less. That's how you proceed.
I take the court's point, but petitioner's problem here is that he has never pointed to any admissible evidence that could have been discovered, and it was his burden before the state court to bring that forward. We're doing a D1 determination here. We're only based on what the state court had presented to it. And if these affidavits were the best that petitioner could do, then there was no hope at all of a different result. And, of course, the admissibility of the evidence does matter for the prejudice analysis, even if for performance we are to assume admissibility. In terms of the inconsistent theories, this Court recognized in Wilson versus United States that presenting two such inconsistent theories can lead to the petitioner shooting himself in the foot for a few different reasons. As the Harrington Court noted, for a reasonable doubt defense, sometimes it's better to have a pervasive suspicion of doubt over the case than try to prove a certainty that exonerates. If you bring forth both of these theories, there's a chance that the trier of fact is going to focus on Elizabeth, and because the evidence that seems to implicate her is so very weak, it makes the defense look unprincipled. It also, as Your Honor pointed out, potentially presents the state with a motive for the crime that it did not previously have, and runs the risk that it might induce Elizabeth to testify in order to exonerate herself. So there's certainly many strategic reasons why counsel could choose, since he did know about this theory, based on our information from Eloise Chambers and Drew Terrell Sr., it's a good strategic reason not to try to present this theory and instead to focus on trying to get the confession suppressed based on a police coercion theory at pretrial, and then try to cast a pervasive suspicion of doubt based on the idea that petitioner had left the child alone in the apartment, which he did testify to at trial. He stated that he left the apartment for about 30 minutes that morning and went out and about, and we know that this apartment was unsecured and that it was a 2-year-old girl left alone. In terms of the prejudice prong, petitioner hasn't shown any admissible evidence that he would have been able to present that would have led to a substantial likelihood of a different result. And the Harrington Court emphasizes that this likelihood has to be more than just conceivable. It must be substantial. Counsel can present the hearsay from the relatives, and I would point out that much of the evidence that petitioner relies on is, in fact, hearsay, even beyond the confession. Much of the evidence about the supposed sexual abuse of petitioner, that is all hearsay. We have no information that from Elizabeth that she sexually abused him, and no information from petitioner at all. Same as to the...
But you know, on that point, I suppose, had the lawyer properly investigated, there could be police records, there could be medical records, there could be other people. I mean, you know, it's all just ground untilled, basically. It's not done.
If it could have been found, and if it could have, then his post-conviction counsel in Exhibit J could have presented this information. The fact that he didn't means that he did not carry his burden before the state court of bringing forth the information to support this rather extraordinary theory of the crime. Unless the court has any other questions?
Nope,
we would
apparently not.
To affirm. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Anything further, Ms. Steigman?
A few points, Your Honor. Counsel has repeatedly said that Mr. Terrell never told trial counsel, and there's no affidavit from him. The law says he doesn't have to, especially where counsel was on notice. Even the respondent concedes in their brief that Elizabeth had complete control over Mr. Terrell and could have manipulated him into confessing on her behalf. If even respondent thinks so, it's unreasonable that the trial counsel did not pursue this defense.
Maybe I missed that. Where was that?
I believe it's at respondent brief page 26. Also, counsel highlights that the court asked me that about him telling relatives, if there's anything beyond what Mr. Terrell was telling his relatives. The relatives knew of the abusive relationship on their own. It wasn't words that Mr. Terrell put into their mouth after he was convicted. Furthermore, they knew about the cover-up themselves. That was not his words in their mouth. Most importantly, Elizabeth herself confessed to her own brother. And as my last point, as Ms. Judge Wood pointed out, there's a huge gap in the record as to what counsel did. And at the very least, Mr. Terrell is entitled to a hearing, an evidentiary hearing in federal court as to what counsel did. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And you were appointed, were you not? We appreciate your help for the court and also, of course, for your client. Thank you as well to the state.